Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African Studies Center titled Traveling the Road of the Orishas. Our speaker is Cheryl Sterling, Liberal Studies Program Master Teacher at New York University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Professor Edouard Boustan from the Department of Political Science at Boston University.
Our guest today is Cheryl Sterling, and Cheryl is known to several of you personally, but for those who don't know her, I should mention that she seems to have been spending most of her life, certainly most of her recent life, in Brazil, and on almost continuous basis, as a matter of fact, and as a recipient of several fellowships. She's been working mostly in San Salvador de Bahia, and but before that, she got her BA at Fordham, her master's, or an MPhil actually, from the University of Ghana at Lagon, and for total change of climate, PhD at Wisconsin. So without further ado, here is Cheryl Sterling.
Much has been critiqued about the imagined Africa of the diaspora, and I dare say Paul Gilroy's dismissal of notions of origin or root and Edward Glissant's implacable stance on root cultures as atavistic, totalitarian, and destructive are due to diasporic subjects' inability to ground themselves in specific locus or cultures in the areas of West and Central Africa and Southeast Africa from which the slaves came. Unlike European immigrants, who can kind of proudly proclaim their attachment to root sources, Africans during the slave trade did not enter into ships because of manifestos guaranteeing their betterment due to immigration. Albeit in the context of Brazil, the entry logs on the slave ships often reported the port of embarkation, and this becomes very important in the narrative of Afro-Brazilian identity. But still, they didn't list the ethnic identification, specific ethnic identifications of these family, of these Africans, nor did they tell us anything about the families that traveled with them on the same journeys. Hence, like all Afro-diasporic spaces, the discursive pendulum shifts from how to define Africa in Brazil to suggesting that the relationship with Africa is largely mythical or imagined, and thus debunking processes of identification with African root sources. Now, this work exists in the space of consideration of Africa as a bridge too far for diasporic subjects, and within kind of County Cullen's existential inquiry from his famous poem, What is Africa to Me? My questions that I pose, I ask collectively, would there be controversy regarding imagined relations or imagined knowledge of an African past if there were systematic investigations into social and class hierarchies, education or knowledge systems that enslaved Africans brought with them from their points of origin? When Afro-diasporic societies are explored by disambiguating institutional organizations, strategic communication, and deliberate infusions of an epistemic tradition from a chosen point of origin, what types of understanding and information does it contribute to positioning these societies in relation to root sources? And when memory becomes an actual unit of factual analyses instead of coded as fictional recreations, how does the information yielded affect knowledge about the disruptions, continuities, and transformations of diasporic peoples, and specifically here, Afro-Brazilian peoples? And if we approach the study of an Afro-diasporic epistemology and metaphysics as traveling theory in light of Edward Said's conceptualization of how theories change and when they're subject to migration, will it similarly lead to his conjecture that such transformations parallel shifts in subjectivity and address issues of power? So this inquiry really stands in the midst of looking at institutionalizations of a specific record and a deliberate recording of memory within the structures of Candomblé. Now, while most Afro-diasporic societies, we can speak quite evenly about the enslavement processes in all Afro-diasporic societies, A crucial difference is found in the quantity of enslaved that came from similar regions in both Central and West Africa and Brazil. And in turning the lens to a particular West African group, the Yoruba, shifts the paradigm undergirding the sense of impossible longing and loss kind of characteristic of diasporic exile. I've argued in other works, and other scholars have also argued, that Africa is really a metonym for a specific Yoruba-derived world and worldview, reconfigured by the dominant presence of Yoruba-speaking peoples in Salvador da Bahia. Such Yoruba ascendance is predicated on a complex set of influences, kind of a multiple striated rhizomatic dispersal in the line of how Glissant theorizes it. But he theorizes a fertile, poly-rooted network of contacts and synergies that form from the rupture of the slave experience. Glissant's root, however, does not go back beyond slavery. And in Brazil, when we think of this, it becomes almost an impossible theory to grasp our understanding of what happens in this particular context. Because in Brazil, slavery ended, of course, in 1888. Some people would also argue it ended in 1988. A generation or two later than most other diasporic societies. Also within the history of Brazil, we see a history of manumission that's much more comprehensive and larger than other diasporic societies. We also have a history of cross-generational journeys of Africans coming from going between the ports of Lagos specifically, but not just Lagos, different areas in West Africa and Salvador. Now, this period is a period that's highlighted between 1830 to 1930. And within this is the formative period of Yoruba ascendance in the city of Salvador. The Yoruba was such a dominant population that their language became the lingua franca amongst the African peoples within the city. What the Yoruba were able to do, they were able to create autonomous institutions. These were organizations for their social and economic betterment, which they structurally recreated from Yoruba anthology, and as well as from their social, political, and economic systems. The main institution, as we'll continue, was sourced within Candomblé, and Candomblé as the transference of African religious doctrine. And as we turn our lens to this Yoruba-defined universe, we're speaking about Candomblé Nago. Now, scholars such as João Reis, Nicolau Pares, Rachel Harding, Kim Butler, Roger Bastide, they consider Candomblé to be a Pan-African synthesis that took place during the 18th and 19th centuries. And this in many ways is very true. The metaphysical knowledge was consecrated in Tejero communities, which are religious enclaves that worship the different African deities. Specifically, these Tejero communities were set up to venerate the Orisha. And with the dominance of Yoruba-speaking peoples, the Yoruba template of naming the gods, their mythos, their songs, their dances, their offerings were superimposed on other African religious structures, which puts all Candomblé practices under a Yoruba homogenizing rubric. Now, differences do exist, and there are different types of Candomblé that tell us about these differences. For instance, there's Candomblé Caboclo, which is more of an indigenized Candomblé structure. There's Candomblé Angola, which tells us more about the Kikongo Bantu influences on Candomblé. There's Candomblé Gege or Jeje, which comes from a more Ewe-defined world. But the idea still is that each of these different Candomblé structures have taken on a Yorubaized structure and used it to create a certain sense of institutionalization for the religious practice. Knowledge derived from this ontological source is constitutive, performative, and lived, and it's subject to intellectual scrutiny, theoretical and philosophical formulations, and rigorous practices, because the Orisha personify natural forces, or their archetypal heroes are anti-heroes with transcendental properties, then these stories of the Orisha become lessons for human action and for human interaction. Afro-Brazilians refer to this ontological source as Nossa Matriz Africana, our African matrix. When viewed as traveling theory, it must be asked what was carried and what was left behind. And it further leads to queries as to what were the conditions and terms of its reconfiguration, and how does its present form appear? Does it appear at all like its originating context? And if not, what makes it so different? Now, the title of this talk, the idea from Yoruba identity to the Nago ideal, is somewhat misleading because it implies a transference of Yoruba identity from West Africa to Brazil. And this is not really what it intends to mean. What we see really is that there was a simultaneous development of identities. Yoruba identity was created in West Africa, whereas Nago identity was similarly created in Brazil during the same period of time. So the transference is really more the transference of the ideas of the Orisha. Now, the Yoruba in West Africa, the term Yoruba comes from the Hausa term, Yariba, and that translates to the people over there. So the Yoruba basically, during the way that they identified based on their place and their locales. They identified based on the city, states, and empires to which they belonged. So they were people who were people of Ondo, people of Oyo, people of Ketu, people of Ijesha. Okay, with the wars, however, in West Africa, the wars between the Oyo and Dahomey kingdom from 1750 to the 1820s, the wars from the Islamic north, of course, this started to shift the rubric of identification as more Yoruba peoples, speaking peoples, were sold in the trade across the ocean. With this changing sense of ascendance, the ascendance occurs more and more within the Yoruba pantheon. We could say that the Yoruba in Yoruba land took on an identity as other within their own spaces and places. But when they come to Brazil, they create a different identity, an identity based on what they wanted to keep in terms of in the midst of their enslavement. The term Nago, which is used to identify Yoruba descendants, there's some controversy as to where the term derives. One group says Nago comes from Anago, which is a subgroup of the Yoruba. Another group says Nago comes from Anago, but Anago is really the language of the Yoruba. Either way, when the slaves arrived on this side of the world, in the Portuguese side, in the Brazilian side, they used it as a point of identification. And this is something that occurred across the board. They created new set collective identities based on that port of embarkation or a larger dominant group to which they subscribed. And so you see slaves who came from areas like Nupe, Hausa land, the Fon people, or even Oyo, if they were Muslim, they collectively identified as Malay. And so we see these larger groupings also being replicated within the Candomblé structure. Now, my take on this is that these concepts of identity weren't born out of a sense of diasporic alienation, but they were willed reconfigurations of identity to form new affiliations and new alliances. And these new alliances and new affiliations really was to serve them better in slave society, Brazil. So Nago identity is a major form of this willed strategic reconfiguration. And given the dominance of the Yoruba peoples, this, of course, became a natural form of identity. And even Africans who first subscribed to another Nassau started to identify as Nago because it became much more beneficial to them to be part of this newly formed identity. João Reis tells us that by the second half of the 19th century, about 79% of the slave population and 59% of the free population identified as Nago within the city of Salvador. Now, why did they specifically choose the Nago identity? of course, because of the numeric force of the Nago people. But we have to come back to the whole issue of the benefits of the common social and economic institutions that this dominance helped to create. And these institutions were in different levels of the society. First, there were the cantos, which were contractual labor groups, and I'll return to that in just a second. The juntas de alforria, they were manumission groups. There were hermandages, which were the Catholic lay organizations, and lastly, condomble structures. Within the city of Salvador, slavery was different because it was urban slavery. And so the free and enslaved population lived together rather than separately. And they did not live, the slaves did not live with their masters. Rather, they had to provide some of their wages to their masters during a period at the end of the week after the week of work. And so for you to benefit and really get the work that you needed to pay your master and still keep monies for yourself for your own manumission, you had to form alliances. And people aligned across with the cantos across the Nassaus. And with the greater groups of Yoruba peoples, it became more advantageous to align yourself as a Nago in a Nago Nassau and to align yourself with a canto that was Nago. The manumission groups, people helped each other to gain their freedom. They would loan monies and in exchange for your time, for you to repay the monies or for your labor. And so these manumission groups also formed based on the Nassau that you were part of. And, of course, the hermandages, the Catholic lay organizations. These Catholic lay organizations became sites where African culture could be preserved. Within these organizations, African languages were spoken. And not only were African languages spoken, the religious rituals took place within the hermandages because they could not be openly practiced. One of the most famous hermandages to this day is the Hermandade de Boa Morte, And this hermandage is a hermandage of women. To this day, for you to become a part of the hermandage, you have to be over 40 years old. You have to be an initiated member of the Yoruba religion, an initiated Mai de Santo, and you have to be recognized as an initiated Mai de Santo. And you also have to kind of trace back your lineage in the line of Yoruba descent to be a part of this group. Now, these organizations were succeeded in a way that the religious structure didn't succeed as an institution as yet because they were less patrolled by the dominant culture. They didn't patrol as much the economic groups, and they didn't patrol the religious groups, especially since the hermandages had the Catholic guise. When we come to the whole idea of candomblé and candomblé institutionalization, it takes us into the greatest form of institutionalization by these Africans. And we have to look at the beginnings of the first Nago Tejero and the way in which folk memory works within this institutionalized process. A fact less admitted to, especially amongst Afro-Brazilians, is the quantity of freed Africans who owned slaves in Brazil. But in this society in particular, it was quite commonplace. And the people, the freed Africans who owned slaves, they preferred peoples of their own ethnic group, whom they call parentes, the Portuguese term meaning relatives. The first documented candomblé house comes out of this relationship. And this house was consecrated around 1830. The house is called Ashe Ile Naso Oka, and today it's known as, popularly known as Casa Branca, the White House. And if you see it, it's a white house on the top of a hill. Mm-hmm. Now, the myth of origination, which is passed down through the members of the Tejero, was that Casa Branca was founded by two women. One with the title or the name, they thought this was a name at first, Ia Naso. And the other was another priestess, her name was Marcelina da Silva. And the myth states that these two women went to Yoruba land and they returned with a priest of Ifa called Bamboche Obatiko. And when they returned with Bamboche Obatiko, he consecrated what's called the Shire, the established doctrine of institutionalization of the Orishas in this Tehera. One of the things that we have to understand is the belief structure that occurs within the Teheros. And that the belief system is that the Orishas actually have relocated from Africa. So they relocate and they inhabit the space at that moment. So what he institutionalized was the Orishas that would be venerated. Within the Yoruba pantheon, there are 401 Orishas. 16 were institutionalized in Brazil. And this becomes really important because we could really look at who was brought and who wasn't brought. In terms of who wasn't brought, there's a major Orisha that you may find in other diasporic places that you don't find in Brazil. And this Orisha is Orisha Oko, and he is the Orisha of farming. Okay, and we can kind of access the mindset. You know, farm. Even though these slaves in particular were urban slaves, the dominant economic production of the slaves was farming. So why bring an Orisha and worship an Orisha that signified your enslavement? So the Orishas that were brought were really Orishas that could help the people in their daily struggles and to help them foment some level of protest against the forces around them. So in the Shirei, he brought these Orishas. He established the order of worship. He established the food, the song, and basically the ritual context. Now, what the historical documents show is that the Ianasso was a freed woman, and her name was Francisca da Silva. And Marcelina da Silva was her former slave and her initiate daughter. She initiated Marcelina in the religion. In 1837, Francisca and Marcelina did return to Yoruba land. And they returned with their families and their entire household. And Francisca owned quite a few slaves, which she freed, and they all returned with her. Now, the documents show that Francisca's sons were accused of being involved in the Malé Revolt. And the Malé Revolt was the major slave revolt in Brazil in the city of Salvador that took place in 1835. And they say, anyhow, this revolt had succeeded, it would have changed the nature of this space. It would have ended slavery in Brazil. So Francisca, in order to avoid the punishment for her sons, decided to return them all. And this is a period where we start seeing all of these transatlantic journeys in reaching their apex. Now, Francisca is the titled Ianasso. And this title is the chief priestess of the shrine of Xangô in Oyo. This is a title that is given through initiation and through merit. This is not a title that can be just taken and used. And if you are an initiate who believes in the structure and the system of Candomblé or the system of this religion, you would never use this title without being deservedly, you know, meritorious of this title. But also within the history, only Marcelina returned to Salvador. And she returned in 1844, almost 10 years later. And she returned with her children. And she took up the running of the Tejero again. Now, Bamboche Obatiko was a slave in Salvador. He didn't come back from Yoruba land. He was a slave within Salvador. And there's speculation that he may have a relation of indebtedness to Marcelina under the Yoruba Iwofa system. And the Iwofa system what was part of the processes that was in place in the city to help aid each other. Okay, with this, what they speculate, because her signatures are in his manumission papers, that she enabled the purchase of his freedom. And in exchange, as part of this Iwofa system, he had to give her a certain amount of his labor. So his labor would be in creating the Shire. So post this period, Bamboche Obatiko is seen all over Brazil and in West Africa, and specifically in Lagos. His services as a priest of Ifa was in demand. So he traveled up and down the coast of Brazil, helping to create structures for Tejeros, and also going back to Lagos to refresh his knowledge and became a patriarch both in Lagos and in Brazil, in Salvador. Two lines of his family still exist on both sides, and they keep in touch with each other. And you can visit each side if you decide to do this sort of research. Now, if he did, and there's still speculation because it's not quite sure if he did, if whether he created the Shire or not, but all evidence points to the fact that he did. If he did create the Shire for the first house and for all of these others, then he is the person that we have to look at as the beginning of the institutionalization in so many ways. But when we look at Marcelina, when we look at Bamboche Obatiko, we also have to start thinking about these transatlantic journeys and think of the many that went back and forth between West Africa and between Salvador, and realize that it's specifically in relation to Brazil that these were not aberrant journeys. What happens over the next 100 years is a relationship that became solidified even more, a relationship of trade, of exchange of ideas, and education between Africans on the west coast of Africa and Africans in Brazil. Post the Malay Revolt, many, many freed Africans returned to West Africa. And basically, Salvador became more intolerant of the freed population because they believed they were the ones fomenting the rebellion. And so, speculatively, they're not quite sure. Looking at the ship logs, something between 3,000 to 8,000 returnees have been documented from the period of the late 1830s, 1840s, to the 1870s, 1880s. Such journeys were facilitated by the quantity of ships that came to Salvador's port, 2 to 3 per week, which either came from West Africa, or if they came from West Africa, many times they journeyed towards Cuba and then came over to Salvador. So there's also another relationship that's extended there, which hasn't been the point of my research. So they came either from West Africa or they were going to West Africa. With these journeys, what we see is that the sense of the Yoruba corpus of sacred knowledge was constantly refreshed. The freed Africans who stayed in Salvador, they preferred to send their children to West Africa, specifically to Lagos, to be educated. And also, with the quantity of Afro-Brazilians that go to some place like Lagos and also to places like Accra, they also sent their children to Brazil to be educated. So a constant intersection between the two worlds. The height of this transmission occurred, however, with the next generation of Babalawos. And these are considered the diviners of Ifa corpus. The two main Babalawos in this next generation are Marciano do Bonfim and Felisberto Souza. Felisberto is the grandson of Bamboche Obatiko, born in Lagos. And Marciano do Bonfim is the son of what they call an Africano Livre, and I'll explain the difference. His name was Eliseu do Bonfim. An Africano Livre was different, you know, it's a freed African. But he's different from the people who are freed in Salvador because these specifically refer to the people that the British freed who were part of the illegal transportation of slaves. Okay? So Eliseu settled in Brazil, but he was known to be originally from Abeokuta, and he was one of the many traders who went back and forth. He had very established relationships within the Candomblé community and specifically with Marcelina. So he and people like he and Bamboche facilitated journeys back and forth. Marciano, his son, he sent him to Lagos to be educated. So Marciano became educated in English, and he also became educated as an Ifa diviner. Now, when they both finished their initiation, they came to Brazil to practice. Marciano stayed in Salvador, and Felisberto, he went to Rio. And these two Babalawos, because the Ifá tradition is very rare in Brazil up till this period, the last 10 years, these two Babalawos are part of this grand narrative of Ngo ascendancy, because they were the most influential advisors in the growth of the Ngo Tejero structures all over the country. As drivers within the religion, they were the advisors for all the Maide Santos, and they helped to create what we know, what it's called as a Pureza Ngo ideal, an ideal of Ngo purity. Now, this ideal of Ngo purity becomes a narrative of authenticity. It's a narrative of authenticity and a narrative of root source. So all the Tejeros, no matter what sort of rubric you in, what sort of governing structure, were judged according to this Ngo purity. And if you didn't fall in line with their homogenizing principles, you were judged as inferior. So very much so, it became a discourse of power that conferred on the people who were the ascendant people in these Tejeros a transcendence and a hegemony within Salvador. Now, Marciano was credited with creating a structure that's called the Obas of Xangô, and he created in one of the Ngo Tejeros. And this Ngo Tejero was called Ile Ashe Apo Afonja. Now, I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. The main Ngo Tejeros in which this idea of the Pureza Ngo ideal even still applies are the three main Tejeros, Ile Ashe Apo Afonja, which I just spoke about, Casablanca, and the third is Gantoa. These Tejeros still very much exist and follow the line in which, you know, from that comes from the beginning of this Shiri. Now, what Marciano did in this creation of the Obas of Xangô, he transfigured the hierarchical structure from the shrine of the chief priest of Xangô in Oyo, who has 12 assistants delineated by the order of authority. They have 6 assistants that are on the right, this is my right, and 6, you know, which are the Oton, 6 assistants on the left, the Osin, and he reproduced their numerical significance and gave them titles within from Yoruba history. These titles were given to influential people in Salvador who could protect the Tejero and the Ngo Tejero, all the Ngo Tejeros, from persecution by the authorities. Now, Marciano did this in the early 1890s, and this becomes extremely significant because this is just post the slavery era. And during this period, Afro-Brazilians faced immense persecution for practicing the religious tradition and other African traditions, even more so than in slave society Brazil, because Brazil was beginning a process of modernizing the structures and the culture. And they saw African traditions as contra the ideals of modernization. So people were subject to immense police prosecution for practicing the religion. Marciano, in creating this hierarchical structure, he brought in prominent people from all around the city of Salvador, and he gave them these titles and these positions of authority. And so if anyone dared to cross the borders of these Tejeros to sort of persecute the practitioners, they always had people to protect them. So he's recreating an ideal structure from the political system and making it into a religious system. So we see another level of where memory gets recoded in a system such as this. One of the ways in which Candomblé is always represented in Brazil, and specifically Candomblé, is that it's the seat of matriarchal power. And with the Shire coming through the line of Bamboche, solidified through Marciano and Felisberto, we do see this guaranteed a position of female dominance and supremacy in the Ngo Tejeros. The Ngo Tejeros specifically follow a strict hierarchical structure where they're governed by a supreme Mãe de Santo or a Ia Lorixá. There's a second in charge, and in Portuguese, she's called the Mãe Pequena, the second mother. In Yoruba, internally, this is how they refer to each other, she's the Ia Kekere, the small mother. There are other Mães who have very specific duties, like the Ia Lache. She cultivates the ashe of the Orishas, the Iyabase, who cultivates the food and the herbology. There's the Iyatetebe, who learns the dances and the songs. And, of course, there's a host of Yawos, initiated followers, who are filias, who become filias and filias, the santos of this tejero. What makes the Nago tejeros different from other tejeros was the fact that they did not allow men to incarnate the Orishas in public spaces or in ceremony. In private ceremony, that was allowed, but in public ceremony, it was never allowed. So this was also, the tejeros became a way for women to safeguard a collective space for themselves. And so the men were given very specific roles. They were the ashoguns. They were the ones who did the sacrifices. They were the drummers. They were the ones that played the agogo. Thank you very much. Okay? And it wasn't that they didn't have the sacred knowledge. They did have the sacred knowledge. It's just that it could not be displayed in the public sphere. And if you go, even today, if you go to a tejero, and you go specifically to the Nago tejeros, the women all sit in state. It's like you're dealing with the queens, you know, and you must treat them as such because of the respect that's of having this kind of transcendental power. Now, all the supreme Mai, the santos, have an initiation history that goes back to Ia Naso and to Marcelina da Silva. So if you ask them, they will trace back through the generational line and go right back to that, to those first two women. And at one time, in order to become the head of a Nago tejero, you had to have an authentic, provable African bloodline. So if you weren't of definitive African descent that could be traced, if you could not tell the ancestor that came directly from Africa, then you could not head a tejero. So these ties between Lagos and even other ports like Ouida, these were ties that authenticated all of that power. And we see even up to 19, present day, but one of the most conspicuous points of these authentications occurs in 1942. When my senora, who was the great-granddaughter of Marcelina da Silva, when she took the leadership of Ile Ashe Apofonja, she received confirmation of her positionality as a cultural purveyor, a Yoruba descendant in the New World, and a spiritual leader from the Alafin of Oyo. And she was conferred the title of Ia Naso. Almost as significantly, the letter of this kind of symbolic coronation was carried by Pierre Verger to her. Okay? Well, and this title, of course, holds dual significance. In it belonging to the founder of the Nago tejeros, and it's as recognition as the head priestess in the system, in the shrine of Shango, it tells of her metaphysical ascendance. Now, we could say that the Alafin, this was maybe an empty diplomatic gesture on his part. We could speculate that maybe he was making amends in some way, or he was kind of basically affirming these ties. We don't know why he did this. But what it does for my senora in Brazil and in Salvador, I should say this is Brazil overall, it confers on her the position of being the premier Mai of this entire country, because she's been sanctioned by ancient authority with her leadership. And so this becomes, you know, another level of the narrative of authentication, another level of the narrative of the root source. I want to switch this a little bit to the discussion of how memory is transmitted, and specifically to address the concept of embodied memory, and specifically how the Orishas continue to live amongst the initiates within this system. Now, theorists like Gilroy and Glissant, who speak of this impossibility of Africa for the diasporic subject, have never really examined the impact of the spiritual. Now, spiritual work according to Jackie Alexander, is really a call to memory. And in African-based cosmological system, the spiritual exists with bodily praxis in a symbiotic political relationship, and political, social, and cultural relationship. Theoretically, there are four different types of memory. The habitual, which are skills and behaviors which are acquired through repetition. The cognitive, the capacity to remember learned facts or previous experiences. The personal, recalling events from one's life and past. And the collective, this knowledge acquired from education and historic sources. And what we find, working with the spiritual, all aspects of memory codification exist. The endless repetition of bodily praxis is seen in prayers, invocations, drum calls, singing, dancing, offering of food and drink, and the ebos, the sacrifices of appeasement to the Orishas, are done in simultaneous activity with different prohibitions on consumptions of food, drink, sexual intimacy, types of dress, and the comportment of the supplicant. Such bodily processes are ritualized, and the practitioners become habituated in their actions to the extent that they become codified and then formalized in oral transmission. Okay, what I call these oral kinetic inscriptions on the body become formulaic chants, songs, calls, prayers, and divination sequences, which Afro-Brazilians see as integral to their African matrix. This practice lives and becomes part of what we call now the praxis of embodiment, the way that memory is encoded on the body and seen in ceremony. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much for really, fascinating, because in my mind, I am just looking for Jinga and memory in Brazil for my chapter on my book on Jinga, Memory, and Nation. And in fact, the difference I see is that with the Angola-Congo, in Pernambuco, in Recife area, where there were, in fact, again, in the 17th century, in the majority of the population, that you had, the language of the, Kimbundus being spoken, Mbundu. You had, in fact, all the organizational kind of a beginnings of this sort of inscription of African, or what I would call, in fact, a mix, because those populations had already incorporated Christianity. And what actually comes in force is, in fact, congadas, maracuta, and other types of performance kind of a memory. And that this is where Jinga, this is where the King of Congo is remembered.
Yeah.
What is different about the Yorubas in Salvador is, in fact, it becomes kind of it begins very ethnically specific and seem to continue somewhat, even though there are many, non-Afro-descended population in Yoruba. In the case of the Congo, Angola, Central African markers, they, in fact, become generalized Afro-Brazilian, Afro-culture, so that everybody takes part in the congadas. And, in fact, these are now, even in the carnival just last year, you had, in fact, Jinga being honored as the queen of it. And they're now beginning to historicize it. But it's not an exclusive. It's part of Afro-Brazilian culture. So I'm wondering if you could speak to the extent to which the Yoruba markers have either remained more ethnically African-centered, as against the Central African, a sort of input, which, in fact, from the very beginning was much more fluid and much more sort of incorporated into, let's say, Nossa Senhora de Rosario. If they didn't want you to come into Central Africa, Jinga was going to send all those priests. They caught one and sent him back. So they actually consciously prevented the sort of more African elements from the Central Africa to, in fact, be, be in Brazil. I just wanted to bring those differences. Thank you.
And you would say, yes, definitely, within Salvador specifically, and as you're crossing the nation, there's this deliberate desire to re-encode the Yoruba pantheon even more, and Yoruba symbology. it's now, I would say now, being part of a Tejero, being part of the Candomblé community, and specifically this Yoruba-derived world, is a political injunction and inflection. And since Afro-Brazilians are still the kind of denigrated and degraded groups within the society, they're using it as a way to say, well, our culture is as important as other cultures. And our culture is pervasive in this way. And they're taking this cultural form in every form of their in their creative endeavors. Now, my work, my book, I not just look at Candomblé. I don't really look at Candomblé deep inside the ritual. I'm looking at Candomblé as a performative template. And you see not just as a discursive, but also in performance. And you see the way that they use the template in creating plays. You see the way that they use the template in carnival. You see the template in their poetry. You see the template in hip-hop. You know, you see the template crossing all different forms. And it really has become the metonym of what Africa is in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for an interesting talk. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit further about the point that you raised right at the end, which is sort of the racial politics of this? Because a lot of what you've talked about focused on authenticity, this idea of having to prove your connections to mm-hmm. Yoruba land and to the mother continent. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of curious, how much is this an exception? How much would it raise eyebrows in any way on people's parts? And is there are certainly cases mm-hmm. where the sort of lighter skin that you are, mm-hmm. the more likely you are to be in a leadership position. I would guess that that's generally not the case here. But if you could just talk a little bit more about the politics of it.
Well, this is, as I said, this is not a Candomblé Nago Tejero. This is a Caboclo Tejero. And it's traditionally seen as a syncretized Tejero because it's more syncretized with the indigenous forms. And they are, the Nagos say this is a degraded form of our system. Okay? So it's like there's a definite sense of Nago hierarchy. We are still pure, and these guys are more degraded in how they do things. So my thing with this is that even though they are not of the Nago, they're still evoking the Orisha and still kind of following along with the practices of the Orisha. But this becomes very important within the racial politics of Brazil. Talking to the Nago minds and speaking about this, you know, there's a sense that more and more white Brazilians are participating in Candomblé. And there are different forms of Candomblé, also the Wumbanda, and so on, that they more fully participate in. But the Mais, to justify it, I would say, well, when they do participate, they're taking on a bit of their African ancestry. Because there's the sense in Brazil that no matter if, even though you're white, you may look white, everyone has a foot in the kitchen, as they say. Everyone has a black ancestor. And so you're claiming a part of that black ancestry in doing this in the sphere of the spiritual realm. In the public sphere, that may be a different thing in terms of your privilege and your power in society in general. But in this private sphere, whomever is, either, this is the Pai de Santo, you know, is obviously a black male. Okay, and this again, this is in a different tradition because the Nago houses, you're finding more pies now in the Nago houses. But these pies are the sons of the Mais. That's how they've able to get the positions. But when it comes to the discourse, when it comes to the ritual sphere, when it comes into the hierarchy, he has to bow to the pie. Okay? And so, you know, you must always acknowledge the ascendancy of the person who is higher than you in the hierarchical chain. So it's almost like it's in some ways there's the idea that the religious people are converting the society. Not the society converting the religious people. So they're converting the society to an African belief system. Now how that will expand into the world itself becomes another issue.
I think you said that men could not incarnate the Orisha in public ceremonies or in private?
In public ceremonies, in the Nago Tejeros, okay. At first. But now it depends on which Tejero, okay? Because over the course of my research, I was able to get access to private ceremonies. And so in the private ceremonies, same Nagote heroes, the men were incorporating the Orishas. But, you know, a public ceremony is almost like a spectacle. Okay? And it depends, you know. I would say now the only Tejero that subscribes to this, men can't initiate, can't really incarnate in public, is Casablanca, because it's the oldest. But the others allow it, you know.
And so why is that?
Why it's still, because there's, again, this whole idea of the protection, I think it's the protection of the matriarchal power and the space. Okay, really, this idea of this is a space for women, and it's a space where their power is greater than everybody else's.
And then another question is, the literature that I've read about being possessed, in the Yoruba tradition, it is men will dress as female spirits very often, but in the Americas, men will not dress as women when they're possessed by female spirits. Did you find that to be the case?
They don't dress as women. Okay, but there are certain ways in which you know what Orisha is incarnating. The way they tie, they take the gele off and they tie it a certain way. So you know which spirit, and every tie is different. Okay, so sometimes even though the men don't dress as women, the way that the bow is the tie, it's very feminine because they're incarnating a female Orisha. So all of this, again, there's a more coded text that you begin to recognize and understand. And so when Orisha comes, you don't even have to know that this initiate is, you know, this Orisha. From what you see, the emblems, you know that it's the Orisha.
Thank you, Cheryl, for all this enlightening.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Cheryl Sterling, Liberal Studies Program Master Teacher at New York University. Professor Sterling's lecture was titled Traveling the Road of the Orishas and was presented by the Boston University African Studies Center. Tonight's moderator was Professor Edouard Boustan from the Department of Political Science at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.